This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After September 11th, a lot of Americans wondered why our government hadn't done more, sooner, to prevent terrorism. My guest, Washington Post reporter Barton Gellman, just completed a three-part series of articles examining exactly what the Clinton administration did do and what the Bush administration was doing before 9/11. Gellman is special projects reporter for the national staff of the Washington Post. The Clinton administration heightened its focus on terrorism after the August 1998 bombing of two American embassies in Africa. Gellman says that within days of the bombings, the FBI, CIA, and National Security Agency pinned the blame on al-Qaeda. Clinton approved two retaliatory strikes. One in Afghanistan was timed to kill bin Laden and his associates in their beds, but the attack missed them by a few hours. The other demolished a pharmaceutical plant in Sudan that the CIA claimed was linked to production of chemical weapons for bin Laden. But that claim was met with skepticism around the world, and the strike was seen as a foreign policy disaster. I asked Gellman how Clinton's strategy to get bin Laden changed after those strikes.
The strategy began as an attempt to find bin Laden, to capture him, and if necessary in the course of capturing him, to use lethal force. That was the gist of a finding that President Clinton made, and a finding is a term of art in the intelligence community. It denotes the president's decision or directive that he's going to spend covert funds for a national security purpose, and he's got to notify Congress in a small number of leaders on the Senate and House Select Committees on Intelligence that he's doing so. Now, he amended this three times over the coming year with what they call memoranda of notification. Again, these go to Congress. The first one said, all right, if you can't come up with an operation that captures bin Laden, you can come up with one whose objective is to kill him. The second one said, not just bin Laden, but a small number of his key lieutenants who were named. And the third one says that if in the course of this sort of planning, you find a need to shoot down a civil aircraft, not one filled with commercial passengers, but one flown in the form of a private jet, then you may do that too. And this last one was seen as a significant step because there are very strong inhibitions globally against shooting down civilian aircraft.
And the assumption was that this would have been a foreign civilian aircraft?
The assumption was that it would have been a charter aircraft run by bin Laden for the purpose of either moving around in Afghanistan or more likely for the purpose of leaving there. They worried that as pressure grew on bin Laden and on al-Qaeda, that he might decide to get a Gulfstream or some other fast, small jet and hightail it out of there, and they did not want to let him leave.
And what kind of weapon deployment did President Clinton authorize?
Well, when he first asked his military, how long is it going to take you to strike bin Laden if we find him, the answer was sort of discouraging. It was 24 to 48 hours. Clinton and Defense Secretary Cohen said, we got to shorten that quite a bit. We need a much shorter fuse. And so what they decided to do at first was to deploy two Los Angeles-class submarines in the closest waters in the Arabian Gulf and Arabian Sea and the Indian Ocean with a six-hour alert window. And they also put eventually some AC-130 flying gunships in one of the nearby stands that I've agreed not to name. And the idea was that if they got information on where is bin Laden, where are a couple of his key lieutenants, they would be ready to hit that spot within 6 hours.
6 hours is still a big window. By the time six hours has elapsed, bin Laden or the other lieutenant from al-Qaeda could easily have moved on to someplace else.
Well, this was the insuperable problem of the Clinton administration. They only three times had information they thought was close to good enough that they were able to pinpoint where he's going to be 6 hours from now. And in each of the three cases, they began to ramp up the strike. Clinton gave preliminary approval. They passed targeting data to cruise missiles aboard these submarines. They spun up the engines. And in each case, before they fired, Clinton and his advisors decided to abort, and that's because they didn't have high enough confidence. They had the right place, and in at least one case, it's a very good thing that they stopped. There was this desert encampment. The CIA saw sort of important figure in the center of it, lots of guards, lots of weapons, and they had the idea that it might be bin Laden. They began the process of moving toward a strike. They called it off in the end, and sometime afterward they determined that this had been the falconing party of a very wealthy sheikh in the United Arab Emirates visiting Afghanistan. Had they killed him, this would have been a huge diplomatic disaster.
So Clinton had authorized the execution of bin Laden and some of his lieutenants, but he also put certain limits on the type of force that he was willing to deploy and the amount of risk that he was willing to put American troops in. So what are the limits that Clinton put on this?
There's two big limits that defined his policy and that led to its failure. One was that only standoff weapons would be used. That means weapons aimed and fired from a distance. And for practical purposes, most of the time, it meant cruise missiles. The second limit was that the enemy was defined very narrowly as bin Laden, a few of his key people, and for law enforcement and intelligence purposes, cells of his operatives operating all over the world. What they did not try to do was to find a strategy for attacking the whole network as a whole, as an organic unit. And they didn't look for a strategy to destroy the environment in Afghanistan that allowed it to flourish. That is to say, they didn't go after the sanctuaries.
You say that Clinton threatened the Taliban and told them that they shouldn't, they couldn't continue to harbor al-Qaeda, but he never really took action that followed that up. Why was he reluctant to actually take that follow-up action?
Well, as you say, there's this growth in pressure on the Taliban by the Clinton people in the final 3 years. For a long time, there have been demands, turn over bin Laden, expel al-Qaeda. And the Taliban deflects those with various sort of non-starter proposals. They say sometimes they don't know where he is. They say sometimes we assure you he's behaving. They say sometimes we'll be glad to keep an eye on him for you. Eventually they say submit your complaints to us and we'll submit them to a panel of eminent Islamic scholars and they can decide his fate. For a long time, the Clinton people are trying to create fissures in the Taliban to find someone who wants to get rid of him and to induce that someone to take power in Kabul. Eventually, they decide that Taliban and al-Qaeda are essentially one inseparable unit. So then what they do is they issue what amounts to military threats. The most senior emissary is Tom Pickering, who at the time is Under Secretary of State. He goes to Islamabad. He finds the Taliban representative there, and he delivers this message. Al-Qaeda is our enemy. Al-Qaeda is killing Americans. If you are hosting Al-Qaeda, we are going to hold you equally accountable for Al-Qaeda's acts. This is intended to be interpreted as a military threat, but the Clinton people do not carry it out.
And why not?
They don't think the market will bear it. The domestic political market, the diplomatic market, and in some sense the military one. In order to mount a significant campaign against the Taliban, you need bases in Pakistan, and you need some degree of acquiescence in the Islamic world. And they did not believe they had any chance of either one of those. Again, the Taliban had not killed any Americans. Al-Qaeda had killed some, but not yet enough to create the momentum for an American reaction that September 11th created.
How much of President Clinton's efforts against terrorism coincided with the impeachment campaign against him?
Well, this became a big issue, and it's very hard to figure out cause and effect, but there's no doubt that it did coincide. The last 3 years of the Clinton administration were not only the most active period of covert effort against al-Qaeda, but they were the most active period of political risk for Clinton. He made the decision to launch the retaliatory strikes of August 20th, 1998, he made that decision on the same day that he made a national address admitting that he'd lied about Monica Lewinsky, on the same week that he was going to make his first grand jury appearance. And it's impossible to separate those two events and decide whether the one influences the other.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Barton Gilman. He's special projects reporter for the national staff of The Washington Post. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Barton Gilman. He's special projects reporter for the national staff of The Washington Post. He just concluded a series on the Clinton administration attempts to track down bin Laden and how the Bush administration dealt with terrorism before September 11th. Now, what happened after the bombing of the USS Cole in 2000? Did that change the Clinton approach to terrorism?
It did not, and that's an interesting point. This bombing of the Cole, which kills 17 sailors and nearly sinks one of America's Aegis missile destroyers, comes about 3 weeks before the end of the presidential campaign. Now, as we've discussed, Clinton had conveyed a threat to the Taliban. If there's another al-Qaeda attack against Americans, we will hold you accountable. Now, immediately after the bombing, the guy who is most influential in developing Clinton's terrorism policy, whose name is Richard Clark on the NSC staff, starts saying, okay, time to make good on this threat, time to start bombing the Afghan training camps, among other things. And Clinton doesn't do this for what amounts to two reasons. One is there's about to be a change of government. To launch a new military campaign against al-Qaeda is something that he and his advisors finally decide ought to be deferred to the next president. And I think equally, if not more important, Clinton is devoting nearly all his foreign policy energy and the larger part of all his energy in the last months of his presidency to trying to achieve a comprehensive Israeli-Arab peace, and in particular an Israeli-Palestinian peace. He thinks he's very close on this. It's the legacy he's most interested in leaving. And it's very clear to him that beginning a military campaign against an Islamic State is going to blow up the efforts to forge the Israeli-Arab agreement.
The embassy bombings took place under Clinton's watch. Was terrorism as important an issue to the Bush administration early on as it was to the Clinton administration?
In terms of time and effort and public presidential attention, the answer is clearly no. By the last few years of the Clinton presidency, Clinton's cabinet-level national security advisors were meeting every 2 to 3 weeks to talk about the threat of al-Qaeda. I mean by that the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the head of the CIA, the National Security Advisor. Under Bush, there was no such meeting until exactly a week before September 11th. What there was a fairly broad-ranging review of what should our policy be toward al-Qaeda. And in the course of that review, which takes place two or three levels below the president, there is this growing ambition to have a much broader and deeper campaign against al-Qaeda. What you don't know and what we can't ever know is how much of that would have been carried out absent the events of September 11th. They have these series of drafts. What's our objective going to be against al-Qaeda? And it starts with rolling it back, and it moves on through undermining it, and finally to eliminating al-Qaeda as a threat to the United States and friendly foreign powers. But never before September 11th does the Bush administration commit itself to the covert and overt military instruments that would be necessary to carry that out.
Now, one of the things that was done under the Bush administration before September 11th was a replica of bin Laden's house in Kandahar was built in Nevada. You report about this in your series. What was the point of this replica?
Well, this is a fascinating moment in the history of the fight against al-Qaeda. In the first week of June, the CIA and the Air Force go to this closed-off patch of Nevada desert, and they build stone for stone bin Laden's house in actually it's an Afghan training camp, an al-Qaeda training camp called Tarnak Kila, and it's outside Kandahar. This is the same place where they had got good pictures of bin Laden. It's a four-room villa. They'd got good pictures of him walking out of it the previous October. And they decided this is where he lives when he goes to visit his recruits in Tarnak Kila. So they built his house, and they tested a new and then quite secret weapon against the house. This is an unmanned drone called the Predator, which previously had been known as a reconnaissance drone. It takes pictures and it takes video. But they had put a missile on the thing for the first time, and they developed a secret warhead for it, which is designed to go through building walls and kill people inside the building. They fired this thing at the replica house. They decided it would have killed everyone in the room that it struck. And now, this is a very important moment, now for the first time after a three-year quest, the U.S. government has a way of finding bin Laden and killing him within minutes, not within hours. And between that first week of June and the second week of September, the Bush administration chose not to deploy that in Afghanistan.
Were there opportunities to deploy it? Did they ever know for sure where bin Laden, if bin Laden was at home?
Well, the idea of the Predator is to find him and shoot him at the same time. Mm-hmm. This is a drone that loiters for many hours over an area and looks for something. In this case, it would have looked for bin Laden. Had it found him, there would have been an opportunity to shoot. But there is, in this period, an ongoing dispute between the Air Force and the CIA about who runs this thing, who pays for it, under what circumstance do you use it. It was still, formally speaking, in the engineering and development stage, and so one could argue that it needed more time. But most of all, the Bush people were not giving priority attention to this question. They knew that there's an ongoing policy review, and they're saying to themselves, let's not rush this thing. We're trying to figure out what our broad policy toward al-Qaeda is going to be, and it'll still be here 3 or 6 or 9 months from now.
Well, something else you report about the Bush administration's anti-terrorism efforts before September 11th, this has to do with the Treasury Department. You say there was a new deputy assistant secretary to the Treasury that was appointed before the 11th to coordinate anti-terrorist efforts. But at the same time, Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill suspended U.S. participation in efforts to penetrate offshore banking havens, and these are havens that protect terrorists as well as protecting corporations like Enron.
Well, look, one important aspect of the war against al-Qaeda then and now is tracking its finances and cutting off its sources of funds. What happened under Treasury in the first 9 months or the first 8 months of the Bush administration is that you had a new secretary, Paul O'Neill, who was skeptical of regulation and skeptical of intrusive government investigative activity. And he did two things. He, first of all, cut off support for legislation in Congress that would have expanded the powers of investigators. And second of all, he suspended cooperation with two international efforts to go after the money launderers. One is at the so-called Group of Seven key industrial powers, and the other is at the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, a rather larger club of rich countries. Both had task forces intended to identify and put great pressure on the so-called scofflaw banks, the rogue banks, the banking havens you had in the Cayman Islands, which have, I think, 35,000 inhabitants, bank deposits equivalent to about one-sixth of those in the United States. You had huge, huge financial flows through places whose only reason for existence was hiding the identities of the account holders. And these were used preeminently by drug traffickers and by tax evaders, but it was already known by investigators that exactly the same mechanisms were being used for and essential to the activities of the terrorists.
What surprised you most in researching this series?
I suppose I was surprised, on the one hand, by how much the U.S. government knew about al-Qaeda in the final years before September 11th, and by the inhibitions against striking back. It may be unfair for me to say that I'm surprised by the latter. You know, there's so many priorities available for any government. There's so many threats. In the Clinton administration, you had Iraq, you had the Balkans, you had the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, you had the possibility of war between India and Pakistan, who are new nuclear states. There are crises all the time facing these guys, and the same is true for Bush. And Mike Sheehan, who is a former coordinator for counterterrorism, told me that in any government, at any given time, you can get the attention of the top people to maybe two, maybe three subjects. And terrorism did not make that cut for Bush, and it did not override the other ones for Clinton.
Well, Barton Gellman, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Barton Gellman is special projects reporter for the national staff of The Washington Post. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.